Change may be an essential part of human existence, but today's guest explores the dislocations in human society caused by rapid changes in the world around us. She's Jen Schwartz, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my great friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, storytellers, journalists, novelists, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. This week, we're joined by Jen Schwartz, a senior features editor at Scientific American. Jen, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So you describe your beat as the space between society's acceptance of and adaptation to rapid change around it. Can you explain that a little bit for our audience?
Sure. It really pulls together a lot of things that I've been working on over the years that really fall into the category of how both, you know, individual people and society at large is adapting to rapid change in our world, both with technology and with climate change and now with the pandemic. So I really try to make sense of how we are grappling with uncertainty, how uncertainty is being exploited, and trying to think about solutions for how we could do better to cope with the uncertainty in our world. So it's sort of become something that is, you know, overlapping at all of these sort of big picture things we're dealing with, but trying to tell stories through, you know, specific people or communities or ideas so that it's a little bit easier to wrap our heads around.
You know, you used the word uncertainty there, and it struck me because I think so many people think about science and they associate science with certitude, but there's a great deal of uncertainty. Uncertainty plays an important role in science, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, science is way more about uncertainty in many ways than it is about certainty. And it's interesting the way that science has become, you know, almost like a catchphrase in a lot of our culture right now and in our politics. I always find it interesting when people say they either believe, do you believe science, or, you know, science is real, this capital S science as something that is just purely factual and the utmost truth is really interesting because, of course, science is this iterative, collaborative process where we're always trying to minimize uncertainty. But it's really about, you know, and especially how I write about these issues. How do we make the best decisions with what we do know and taking into consideration what we don't know? And I think, you know, our society at large is pretty bad at doing that in a sane way.
So you have written beautifully about the challenge of climate change. And let's get this question out and off the table immediately. Is there any doubt in the legitimate scientific community that climate change is real?
I mean, of course, there's no doubt. You know, it's really interesting if you really want to nerd out and go to the, you know, the polar research conferences, you will have, you know, ice scientists debating all sorts of things about, you know, the pace of melt or, you know, where it's coming from and how and the mechanisms. And so, of course, there's a lot of ongoing discussion about exactly how these systems affect each other. But in terms of human-caused climate change, there's no doubt, of course. And I think the bigger question that we have to move on to is connecting the sort of science of climate change and looking at the effects of what is already coming our way. And starting to talk about it not as just an atmospheric science thing or even an environmental problem, but really understanding how it's so much about communities and national security and health and all sorts of infrastructure, all sorts of things. So I think that's where we should be focusing now.
So we're going to get into those issues momentarily. But before we do you have any explanation for why there are still people who doubt that climate change is real? And as we know, we've seen from polling, we've seen during this election season, a lot of naysayers still saying, come on, it's bunk. How do you explain that?
I think sometimes we focus too much on the question of, do people believe science or believe that climate change is real? And not enough on the issues of, you know, how do you feel about climate change in your own life? Because I think when you look at a lot of the polling, actually a lot of Americans, the majority of Americans, don't just believe that it is real, but believe that it is going to be affecting them or affecting the country in the near future. And so I think, you know, obviously there have been lots of disinformation campaigns, lobbying efforts, all sorts of, just influence operations over the years to try to prevent climate change from having to deal with it. And so, you know, you make people think that it's not real. But I think when we look too much about this small minority of people who just want to stick their heads in the sand, we're missing this bigger sort of middle ground of people who say, okay, climate change is really happening, and I might have seen some of its effects in my life and in my community, but what do we do about it? And I think people are more unsure about that question. And that's where I think we should be more focusing more in the media and in how we tell stories in general.
In one of your earlier stories from 2018, and it's beautifully written, it's Surrendering to Rising Seas. You describe the efforts of some to quite literally hold back the seas, but others who think it's time to adopt a policy of managed retreat. That was a term that was new to me, and I'm wondering if you can explain for our audience what managed retreat actually entails.
So managed retreat is this horrible sounding term.
It is horrible sounding. I'll agree with that.
I mean, it's, it sounds like the worst mashup of government overreach and also the government not doing enough to help people. But basically it means when we look at our coastal areas and we look at what might be coming down the line with sea level rise, and we look at existing flooding and existing storms like hurricanes, are there certain areas where, you know, the amount of chronic flooding that's going to be coming down and the amount of the episodic, more extreme flooding that we're going to be seeing, do we keep building walls? Do we even have the money to do that? Or do we start to think about portions of communities that get relocated, where people and infrastructure, actually we remove that from an area and you never develop it again? And maybe there are ways to do something then with the land that remains to protect the people and infrastructure that does remain. So it's this concept of, instead of reacting to each storm or instead of building all these walls, do we start to say, it might be more empowering and create less chaos if we can be deliberate about relocation and get honest about how many people are going to be affected by sea level rise in this way.
So clearly this will require a government response at the federal level, the state level, and even at the municipal level. Are we seeing any policies in place now addressing this? And that's probably a large question because I'm guessing it varies region by region in the US, but just speak generally about what is needed and what isn't there yet.
So it's sort of, since we've just gotten through an election, it's a little bit like, you know, each state's electoral processes, where it's so different from state to state and even municipality to municipality. And so there are some states that have much more in place in terms of programs to help facilitate retreat. And then there are states that, you know, don't have anything in place. But we are seeing a lot more on the local level and the state level, certainly more than, you know, 5 years ago. And I think, you know, on a federal level, you know, updates to the National Flood Insurance Program is a big one. How do we stop incentivizing risk and incentivizing people to build in risky areas? But then the bigger question is, what do we do with everything that already exists in these risky areas? And so I think we will ultimately need, because of the scope of what's going on and how complicated it is and touches every sector of government and society, how do we help people adapt, whether they're staying in place or moving, without, you know, making vulnerable communities even more so and increasing, you know, inequality? And so I think we will need, you know, pretty big top-down protocols for how to manage this, but also just a lot of local grassroots support and what makes sense for each community, because it will be different from place to place.
When you write a story like Surrendering to Rising Seas, which is really ambitious in its scope, it's looking at the climate science and the reaction of one community in particular to Superstorm Sandy. It's looking at the impacts on individual families. It's looking at the history of America's coastal communities. When you write something with that scale of ambition, how is that different from a shorter, smaller piece? How much time went into a story like that? How do you actually go about writing it?
I don't recommend the process. When you compared to a shorter piece, I would say I have no idea, because I'm not able to do that. With that story in particular, I started thinking on that topic, you know, over 10 years ago. I think I was in college and I was in Boston, and I had written a story for the Boston Globe about, you know, is retreat going to be something that communities and scientists and politicians start taking seriously? And at the time, no one wanted to talk about it. It was barely on the radar of policymakers and who just didn't want to talk about it at all, because no one likes this concept. And it really took a lot of time for the timing to be right for this feature to come out. Even after Hurricane Sandy hit, the Northeast, and we were sort of reckoning with, what does this mean for New York? You're sort of getting a glimpse of the future, but it would take even a few more years, I think, for people to really see, oh, this is not sustainable long term. And even if lower Manhattan gets a giant wall at some point, how long is that going to be viable? And so many other places are just not going to get that kind of protection, nor does it necessarily work or make the most sense. So I think, you know, it was pretty much a decade long experience of really witnessing the arc of change in how our society thinks and speaks and responds to managed retreat and to climate change in general. And the timing ended up, you know, in 2018, it felt like people were ready to really hear about that. And there were enough examples now where local communities, and then the state level and the federal level, you can really see what a project like this would look like. Whereas before, there was just so little to even talk about. And then, of course, it's fascinating because during the Democrat debates for the primaries, you had these candidates using that term on stage. And I think it was stunning to see that now being a priority for our government going forward.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 19 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Jen Schwartz, a senior features editor at Scientific American. She covers a beat that explores society's adaptation, or lack thereof, to rapid change, as in the climate or technology. Jen is on Twitter too, at Jen L. Schwartz. That's JenLSchwartz. You know, I'm wondering just this story in particular focuses on the coastal communities in New Jersey that were impacted by Sandy. Does a community have to suffer that kind of calamity to be able to have sort of a reckoning with changes in our climate? And is that ultimately what's going to drive the national conversation on it? Is there need to be some sort of, you know, I don't want to say a national calamity because we're in the middle of one, but does there need to be some sort of forcing function that actually compels government to change course on this?
I think it's really hard to get people on board with it in the absence of loss and being personally affected, because you're talking about home. You're talking about people making a choice to give up on home, and not just their house, but the house will go away. The land will cease to exist. And their community, you know, whatever they have in place with neighbors and their lifestyle, it's choosing to say goodbye to that because it's no longer sustainable. And our brains are not typically equipped to make decisions based on sort of future challenges. So I think when Sandy hit, of course, it gives people an opportunity to say, can I go through this again? Would I want to go through this again? And there's this window of opportunity for people to get together and say, maybe there's a better way, or how do we prevent this sort of grief and heartache and financial hardship in the future? And I think we are dealing with these types of events all over the country, whether it's Louisiana with, you know, the few storms where the same communities were getting hit, or even the wildfires. You know, this is not sea level rise, but it shows a future where we're starting to ask ourselves these questions. And hopefully it gets to a point, you know, the idea is that people are going to have to move at some point, right? There's certain areas that maybe are not able to be saved. So how do we do this in a way that avoids, you know, as much of the chaos and heartache as possible?
So do you look back on Sandy as the alarm that people finally heard, or the wake up call that finally penetrated? I covered it for the Providence Journal, and I know from the reporting I did on the southern Rhode Island coast, where the erosion impact was tremendous, where houses were lost. It was just stunning to be there the day after. I know certainly for people in Rhode Island, that event was like, whoa. Is that how Sandy will be viewed, or already is viewed as the event, at least in terms of the coasts?
I think Katrina showed us how much infrastructure and government can fail, and how a storm, a single hurricane that is really bad, illuminates the deeper problems that already existed and were not being dealt with. And so I think you really have to go back to Katrina to see that, you know, this is not something that is going to be going away, and that it really uncovers and just emphasizes the problems in society that already exist and that we need to deal with. And then I think Sandy, when it happened, which, you know, it occurred in an area that people just think in the Northeast and in, you know, in New York, especially, there's so much media, there's so much attention to that area. And it just really emphasized how vulnerable we are. And I think it was a turning point in terms of saying climate change is not just about, you know, global numbers of you know, mean sea level rise and looking at the poles and the polar regions, but really trying to understand how is this going to affect each area, you know, more specifically and with more precision. And so you started to take climate science just from, you know, the atmospheric people and the geologists to the sociologists and the economists and the psychologists. And how are we going to be adapting to this on a much bigger scale. This is not just about the science.
Jen, one of the other important elements of your coverage has been on the issue of disinformation. And that's an issue that we've spent a fair amount of time on this show talking about over the last 4 years. I'm curious your thoughts about why is disinformation the threat that it is today?
So as we all know, it's disinformation, which we should define, I suppose, as intentionally wrong information that is put out there to confuse or cause harm or to, in attempts to gain power, is under the umbrella of, misinformation in many ways, which is just false belief, false ideas that spread. And it's always been around in all sorts of forms, right? And, we understand the history of propaganda and how a lot of, authoritarian regimes in history have used certain messaging and influence operations to confuse, overwhelm, and just muddle the information landscape. But now we are dealing with the internet, of course, and we are dealing with all these social platforms. And what that means in a nutshell is that messages can be precision targeted to whatever demographic group you want them to reach. And so increasingly, we are all living in our own separate realities. And the more that we engage with algorithmic content, the more we are going to be fed things that deepen and entrench the ideas that we're being, that are coming our way. And so what's so dangerous and I think so profound for a lot of people right now grappling with how can we all live in such different realities? How can, it's an emphasis of the us versus them. And there's an issue of how real is that? Is this always how we've been? Have we always been this divided and this era just brings it out? Or are we actually, is it exacerbated by the tools of digital disinformation today?
It seems to me that a pandemic is a perfect breeding ground for disinformation. There is so much fear and anxiety, and also so many people are confined, or mostly confined to their homes and going on their computers a lot, I would argue way too much, including myself. Is that a fair description that this is like a perfect breeding ground for disinformation?
Oh my gosh. Yes. I mean, it's not funny, but it's, before the pandemic descended upon the United States, I was already working with a lot of disinformation researchers and, everybody was so focused on the election. And it was already such a breeding ground for exploitive media manipulation, influence operations, disinformation. And then when the pandemic hit, my gosh, I mean, beyond just the sheer fact that it is terrifying, that it affects all of us, and that there's so much we don't understand about it, there's so much we don't know, there's so much we're not used to, which is already a breeding ground for false belief to spread like wildfire. When you put that in the context of everything that was already going on in our country, it is a terrible time to try to make sense of what knowledge is. And we're all isolated more than we would want to be. And I think, something I always ask myself is, am I going online? Am I going on Twitter? Am I going to look for information because I'm seeking knowledge, I'm seeking news, or am I going there because I'm bored or scared or outraged or terrified or just want to be stimulated by something? Because that's, of course, how these platforms work, is it gets you worked up. So I always try to ask myself, what am I here for? And sometimes I just want to be there for the entertainment and the outrage, but I think it's a good way to try to create boundaries for yourself.
Well, sort of in that spirit, I mean, we've already seen state-sponsored disinformation around the COVID vaccines that are in development. And I think that's likely only to get worse as we actually get to deployment of some of these vaccines. But what can members of our audience do to A, be more mindful of the disinformation, and what should they do if they confront something that is disinformation, if they know what it is?
I do think the thing we've heard over and over, which is to spend less time on social platforms, is still like the first and best step. And to understand why you're going there in the first place, not just jump into it mindlessly. Another thing is to give yourself and your family and friends or people who might be posting misinformation to not attack them and not have a debate about what is false versus what is true, but to think about having a discussion about how much misinformation hurts us all and how overwhelming and chaotic this has been for our relationships and our communities. And I think going forward with something like the vaccine is to, I mean, there's been so much damage done already, and it comes from so many different levels. I mean, the administration in this country, and, you know, trying to rough something out and hook it to political outcomes. But there's also, we have to remember a history of whether it's vaccines or other treatments that were actually used to harm certain groups in this country. Marginalized communities have been hurt by the medical system or the public health system in the past. So there is a legacy of real damage, of mistrust. And so I think in addition to having to build trust from, you know, around the coronavirus vaccine, you know, public health communicators and our leadership, you know, in general needs to take that into account, that there is a history of distrust among many groups. And so I think we have to remember that always, that there is an opportunity here to heal that history and to be more transparent about how this process works and be more transparent about what is being done to rectify the mistakes of the past.
Jen, that is a great place for us to leave it. Thank you so much for being with us. She's Jen Schwartz with Scientific American. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.